prayer. Almighty and eternal Father, again we come into thy presence to worship you in spirit and in truth. Again we know that as thy children, as thy household, that thy purposes shall be carried out. Before you have consummated thy purpose in the earth, you shall have raised the standard of thy kingdom. All the nations will recognize that you have loved thy children and thy household, that you have placed them above all the nations of earth and all the people of earth for the establishment of thy kingdom according to thy plan. We thank thee, our Father, for the covenants and the revelations contained in thy holy word. We thank thee, our Father, for the communion which you have bestowed upon thy children by the presence of thy Spirit, which you sent upon thy household to lead them into the knowledge of all truth, and to bring again into remembrance all the things which you have told us from the beginning, and even those things which we have heard from thee from before the foundation of this cosmic order. We thank thee for the eternal nature, the spiritual center of thy kingdom, thy church, for the great nations of thy kingdom, which you have raised up in accordance with thy covenant, and for the realization that as we stand in these last days of a closing world order, we stand on the birth day of the great new age in which thy kingdom shall emerge triumphant. So as we commit ourselves in thy hand, we pray this hour for Christian Americans all over this nation as they pray and as they worship thee. We pray for the spiritual center of thy kingdom, thy church, that it might once more proclaim all of thy oracle unto thy people. We pray for strong men that stand in resistance to tyranny, whether it be federal or whether it be in the status of world government. We, our Father, pray for these who stand out today, like Governor Barnett, General Walker, and these many who take their stand against internal tyranny. We pray, our Father, for the confounding of the darkness, for the elimination from our land of those that would curse it. We say, do this by thy hand, and at any instance, O God, that serves thy purpose. But deliver us, as you have covenanted to do, as we plead and call upon you to accomplish for us this problem. If this thing cannot be done by these who are thy household, because they know not which way to turn, we pray, our Father, to send in thy mighty ones, and eliminate from this great nation those that would hurt or destroy. We pray, our Father, as we look into tomorrow, for that ascending faith that causes us to realize that this light shall not go out and thy kingdom shall not be destroyed. We know, our Father, that we are in a turbulent time, a time of Jacob's trouble, a time which for all the nations of thy kingdom is a time of great trial, but out of it shall come the great triumph of thy kingdom established and thy order preserved. And so as we commit ourselves to thy hand tonight, we pray that you will bless us in our meditation, cause us to recognize with proper evaluation the hour through which we pass. So we commit ourselves to thy hand, saying, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We turn tonight to survey the situation. We discussed quite thoroughly this afternoon when we talked about being surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. And we discussed the continual invasion of state rights and individual liberties by those who control the federal government. We only mention that there is nothing that is more abhorrent to every free American than increasing federalism guided by the enemies of Jesus Christ and surrounding a president whose mind they must hold captive. Since we spoke to you this afternoon, you had a chance to hear the President of the United States in one of those mealy-mouthed speeches, which was intended to justify his invasion and the felony which he committed. For I charge that the President of the United States has committed a felony. He's violated the rescinding of the right to use the Posse Comitatus Act signed into law by President Eisenhower. And with his ordering of federal troops, which he used today in the state of Mississippi, he has become a felon, either whether there is courage enough in the Congress to charge him for impeachment in the Senate to hear such a case. I also point out against that we are facing the unbridled use of power in design to accomplish a complete submission to the will of a modern dictatorship, which it behoves every Christian to pray shall be brought down in that quickly in these United States. We are continuing in this position that the state of Mississippi and its laws are sovereign for that state when they are not in conflict with the Constitution of the United States. That the laws have not been violated as far as Mississippi is concerned, because the Constitution of the United States leaves the area of education up to the state, and as far as the use of troops in enforcing the law of another case, not this case, we are faced with the fact that there has been an invasion of the rights of the state of Mississippi. More than that, within this
flagrant disregard for the rights of individuals within their states, or what we call state rights, we are watching the increasing danger of an expanding federalism advised and guided by the enemies of Jesus Christ, and using the Negro as an issue in this crisis only to accomplish this thing which demagoguery always likes to do, and that is, behind the scenes, control others to bear the brunt of their conspiracy. I tell you again, as we go out over the tape to all the tape listeners across the nation and throughout the world, that the Constitution of the United States is a constitution of law not intended to be changed and rewritten by the Supreme Court, but to only be used in their cases as the foundation for their decision. We have watched since the fateful Black Monday in 1954 an utter disregard to the intent of the writers of the Constitution, openly admitted in the statements made by these justices, whose attempt was to change the meaning of the Constitution to fit the social revolution that they had politically ascribed to. But the great majority of Christian Americans, when they wake up from their sleep, do not ascribe to this social revolution, which finds its foundations in the writings of Marx and in those that are his apostles to this time. There is no doubt that the support of divine law is the most important thing that you and I as Christian Americans can pledge ourselves to, and the preservation of divine law and the preservation of our Constitution, which was predicated upon divine law, is most important unto us. I want to cite, before we go on into other facets of our message, that I am holding in my hands the speech that President Kennedy recently made on the lawn of the White House to 5,000 college students. I hold this in my hand, and in this statement he said that the Constitution of the United States was written under entirely different conditions that exist now. It has been made to work today in an entirely different world from the day it was written, both at home and abroad. It was written during a period of isolationism. It was written in a period that is different, when 13 different units were joined together, and which, of course, was extremely desirous of limiting the power of the central government. The president goes on to say that we're not trying to limit that power today, and that the Constitution was written for an entirely different period in the nation's history. There's some who feel, he said, good many Americans, that the American Constitution is an automatic light to the future. But he says the American Constitution, while an extraordinary document, is not written for our time, and it is being required to work in a day for which it is not written. Therefore, he said, political leaders and those said that political leaders today may not be as gifted as those in the past to make this institution work, or this document work, but it is not written for modern man. It was written over a century ago, and so, therefore, Mr. Kennedy doesn't believe that we should retain the Constitution because it's an old-fashioned document. Well, he's proved that he doesn't believe in it. It's pretty old-fashioned for him, because he invaded today Mississippi. Now, we point out to you that there are many things involved in this decision. In the first place, the President of the United States has lost the respect of most Democratic leaders of the South. I think it rather significant that the Democratic leaders in the state of Mississippi and in several other states have resigned today, refused to any more become a part of the Democratic Party or to raise any further monies for its campaign programs. A great number of these people have made their affidavit that they're going to join the National States Rights Party, which is quite strong anyhow in the South, and to which in one recent election most of the votes inside of the state of Mississippi went. Rather interested in Los Angeles Times for tomorrow, because it talks about the fact of how Governor Barnett has been offered unprecedented numbers of men, and that these groups and organizations came from many, many states. And among these, I note that it says that from St. Petersburg, Florida, the national organizer of the National States Rights Party said that we have offered Governor Barnett any help he needs, whether it be armed or unarmed. The Reverend Aaron Petito, a minister of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian and also national organizer of the States Rights Party, said all that Barnett has to do is ask, and the leaders of 30 states will immediately be contacted and will come in with reinforcements. This is just one of the factors that's involved. They asked Petito how strong was the National States Rights Party. He said it stood for constitutional government, was opposed to integration, said it would be impossible to estimate at this time the party's size, but its thunderbolt had 25,000 subscribers. We only mention this because he does happen to be a minister of this movement and has taken a rather firm stand in Florida and was and is the national organizer of the National State Rights Party. We tell you that there is a very vital conflict, Dot, and there are many, many thousands of people that have already arrived from Tennessee Mountain Men to a great number of the Southern supporters from Florida as well as from many other states. And your own Colonel Gale is also either in transit or is arriving very shortly inside of this Aryan zone. It's not all over. Just because the governor was recognizant of the fact that the government had given him till next Tuesday. In fact, Governor Barnett had more faith in the honor of the president than I did. But I was in touch this morning with certain leaders, and I said, don't trust the promise of the president. He's going to make a jump move, and he's going to move his military in before his own deadline, and he's only trying to throw people off guard. I had one military man say, well, Dr. Swift, he can't do this because the president doesn't dare do a thing like this after he's given a certain deadline, so we don't have to worry. They can't do anything before Tuesday. I said, he'll move today. There's one thing that you've got to go by, not by military regulations, not by the normal strategy with which men keep their covenant, but by the fact that when a man's advised by Satan's own children, who not only are liars and whose father was a liar from the beginning, then if he follows their advice, he'll play the play of a lie, and you can't trust him. I wouldn't trust a Kennedy if he swore on a stack of Bibles. One of the major concerns today of a great number of those already in Mississippi was to see, and this involves citizens' councils and a great number of others, was to see that the governor was not arrested in his own state. And quite frankly, they had no proper jurisdiction to arrest the governor in his own state, and he was smart enough not to go out of that state. So the governor in his own governor's mansion was surrounded by tremendous reinforcements, which would have been a tremendous fight if they had tried to take the governor. They had only a token force today at Oxford around the school. Why? Because there isn't any school on Monday. There's no school there on Sunday. There's no way to register a student on Sunday, and nobody that has the authority to register would even be there. So only a few state troopers stood idly around at the various gates when Mr. Kennedy made his sneak play. The thing which he did, of course, was to take the paratroopers, which he had already inside, plus other troops, and stand them ready. And then with some army cars and taking the chancellor, who, if they didn't hold captive, Mr. Barnett should immediately discharge. They took the chancellor of the university, and they immediately rushed through the back gates in Oxford to the university grounds. We discover that as they came through these gates, one lone state trooper was there. In the lead car, they had the head of the state police, the state troopers, and they had the chancellor. Whether they've captured these men or how they did this, we do not know. No sooner did they make this quick entrance inside the school than the military, with tear gas guns and full equipment, held the university campus. Nobody had expected their seizure today, but a few of us that know what we were dealing with because we don't trust the devil who's advising every foot of the way the Kennedys follow. Now we point out that it was quite an amazing situation, and before they knew it, the government was in control of the campus of the university. Then they flew the Negro Meredith into the university with a helicopter, thus getting away from the great crowds on the campus now surging around. So they have already set up an apartment inside of the university grounds for this Negro where he's to stay so he doesn't have to come in and out. I wouldn't advise him to go in and out, not now. Then the governor capitulated by saying that we recognize that we are defeated in this measure, that they have taken the school. And I only urge that there be no violence or bloodshed. But the fact is that I will not stop fighting every process available to keep this registration from being made. Now the registrars of the school and the school board has utterly refused to come down and register this Negro today. fact, I would advise that they don't show up tomorrow and that the Chancellor be discharged if he supports the policy. This failing, I think the governor should close the university. Now, we have no control over what transpires in Mississippi, but I think that the battle has just started. Even as we are talking tonight, the students in the university are exploding. They're all fighting reporters from New York newspapers which slant the story, and their riots are going on even now in the city of Oxford. More than that, the state police are not doing very much about it because the situation, which is a little out of hand tonight, is the result of a federal invasion. There has been no leaving of the state, however, and there's no one left that ring that they came into when no one was there. So we do not know what the situation will be from here on out. But I happen to know that the thing that has happened today has recorded in the minds of millions of people the fact that you cannot trust the president. Number two, that the Constitution of the United States is but a scrap of paper in the hands of this man who doesn't believe in its effectiveness for our time and supports the utilization of force, even though it's felonious by the law which now exists. If the president wants to recognize law, then let him recognize the existence of the Posse Comitatus Act, which law he has violated this afternoon. So in this instance, we are watching this phase of what might develop at any time in a rather strange and unique way. I think that it's rather interesting. I hold in my hands a very significant article from the magazine of the American Bar Association. We continually hear about the equality of these people and the essentialness of our respecting and recognizing their equality. They continually hark back to the Declaration of Independence, which declares that document that it recognizes that all men are created equal. Now, in this instance, the Declaration of Independence is talking about men, and the men they were talking about were white men and no one else, because all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, as well as that early Constitution, were white men, and every signer but one of the Constitution, as we said before, was a slave owner, and they never at any time had classified them as men, and they weren't talking about them when they said all men were created equal. Well, you say, what do you mean by that? I mean exactly what I say. They didn't say with one voice and with one signature that all men were created equal, and then continue to hold certain people as slaves. It is also quite obvious that while we oppose all slavery as being diametrically opposed to God's law of the separation of these races from close contact with the people of his household, the fact remains that as far as these statuses of existing patterns were concerned, there never was an accepted principle of equality as far as people were concerned. There was, of course, the old Greek document that was produced by one of the Greek philosophers, which tried to point out an equality of races, but no one accepted this principle, including even Thomas Jefferson, who made fun of this principle under the grounds that whereas we accept as an American principle that all men are equal before the law, we recognize the difference in initiative and in genius that is the gift of God that descends upon men. More than that, when Thomas Jefferson talked, he was still talking about your race, irrespective of its wealth or its poverty, and was not including at that time the sub-peoples of the earth. I also point out to you in this, and I'm reading out of the document of the American Bar Association, which appeared in their bar paper. I read the words of President Lincoln. Now, we do not support all the things that President Lincoln decided on because he had some bad advisors, too. Fortunately, he didn't have as many Jews to advise him as were surrounding the present president, but he had enough. But he did have some God-given intelligence and wit, and when he was brought to a recognition of some of the issues that were involved, I now read the statement which was made on August 14, 1960, 1862, by President Lincoln. This is what he said as he was demonstrating that he did not believe and was not an equalitarian. Speaking before a large group of Negro delegates in Washington, President Lincoln said, "You and we are of different races. We have between us a broader difference than exists between any other races on the face of the earth. Whether it be right or wrong, I need not discuss. But this physical difference is a greater disadvantage to us both, as I think. Even when you cease to be slaves, you are far removed from being placed on equality with white people. On this broad continent, not a single man of your race is made the equal of a single man of ours. This is President Lincoln. Now, go where you are treated best, and the ban will still be upon you. I cannot alter it if I could. See our present condition, the country engaged in war, white men cutting one another's throats, and then consider what we know to be the truth. But for your race among us, there would be no war, although many men are engaged on either side, and they don't care for you one way or the other. It is better for both of us that we therefore be permanently separated. Now, one moment, these people want to quote Abraham Lincoln, but they don't want to quote this. So we point this out to you. I want you to know that the principle that exists in 31 of the constitutions of the nations of the world is that men are equal before the law. But this does not determine that they have a capacity of equality inherent in their natures as races or as individuals. Equality before the law is the principle of your own state. And in the Declaration of the Bill of Rights of your own state, this is something that Chief Justice Warren of California cannot change, for it is says by all men are by nature free and independent. Doesn't say they are free and equal. They are free and independent. They have certain inalienable rights. Among them are those of enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring and possessing and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining safety and happiness. So there is not a member of the Supreme Court that can turn to the Constitution of his own state and say that that state advocates in its principle that all men are equal irrespective of their race or their national origin. I point this out because many people are confused and they think that the fundamental documents of our nation bore out a process by which we have to absorb all people and intermingle and mongrelize our society upon this basis. This is in itself not so. What today makes these men stand out so tall and so strong is the fact that these who have resisted this attempt by the federal government, which is still an attempt, I want you to know, so far Meredith is not yet registered, and we have not heard the last of this situation, nor have they crammed this issue down the throats of the citizens of that state and made them like it by any sense of the imagination. It is true that we are disgusted with men like Governor Price Daniels and Vandiver and others of Georgia who used every excuse to pull out and say this was none of their affair, it was the affair of Mr. Barnett. But someday, all Texans are going to realize this was their affair, as most people of Georgia recognize this now, and most of the southern states. I point out to you that in this issue again, we have watched the President of the United States trying to enforce a decision, which decision the Supreme Court admit was based upon a design to eventually bring together a flowing of the races. I only point out to you the writings of the Swedish communist Myrdal and the Negro Jewish communist Du Bois, quoted by these men to substantiate this. If you would like a full brief on what these men said and how they wrote their decisions, you write to Senator Eastland of the House of the Senate Judiciary and ask him for his complete brief on the Supreme Court decision, and you will receive it with a full statement of what each one of these justices said, which proves that it is not the Constitution that guided them. It was a socialist revolution started by Marx, financed by Jewry, and abetted by a whole world filled with demagogues that served their cause. Now, let's for a moment recognize that we in the past few Sunday nights have been discussing, quite frankly, the patterns of the race question. Basically, we've pointed out there is basic differences between these races, and the Scripture supports this. The Strong's Concordance supports it. The Young's Concordance also supports it. In Young's Analytical Concordance, it points out that the word Adam is used for man 500 times inside of the Old Testament. It talks about the word Enosh and how many times it's used. It makes the marked distinction that the Adamic race are called Adamites and that the Enosh does not refer to those that are non-Adamites. So you see, there are two kinds of people already existing in the world. When you go back to the beginning of the book of Genesis, and we want to substantiate step by step, in as far as we may be able to use the King James Version, for even though somewhat sometimes hidden, there still remains the great substance of the fundamental truth and story in the pattern of these mysteries of the first chapters of Genesis. We point out to you that in the beginning of time when God had created the races, which we have pointed out, and they had spread out over the earth, and we have millions of years of time in the creation, and we have some 1.5 million years of terranians. So you can't actually determine how long those eras were that relate to the climactic sixth era. In fact, if we are to take the actual evaluation, utilizing radiocarbon and utilizing fluorine reemplacement, and start to measure the geologic ages, some of those geologic ages are quite evidently over 1 million years in length. And that there exists, even in that early creation, over 6 to 8 million years, and this we can establish by stratas and measures, and these are quite evident. Everybody knows that the Precambrian uplifts overflowed over an area and created even pressures, and beneath them are oil chambers that came from vegetation that existed way, way back before the Precambrian Age, even though the Precambrian Age was when the earth was washed by Precambrian seas. Someone said, how do you explain this, since we start with a earth awash and come up through the story of the creation in the book of Genesis? First, because there were great catastrophes that had overwhelmed the earth before you even come to the story hidden in its mystery and allegory of the book of Genesis. In fact, the great catastrophes that had overflowed over an ancient world had turned much of the earth's surface down, had placed vast areas of animal life and vegetation deep beneath the Precambrian uplifts of the Precambrian seas. So we note that this catastrophe wiped out an antediluvian and ancient world even long, long before the creation of the book of Genesis. If you do not think so, then why would you drill through a Precambrian uplift to get oil? Oil which is paraffin-based and comes from the vast masses of animal matter whose paraffin substance forms the paraffin-based oils. We not only can establish that this is so, but we can show you some very amazing things as we've referred to some of these things in the past. Drilling down through Precambrian uplift in the areas of Montana, we brought up glazed pottery with ceramics painted on them. And drilling down in Four Corners in the areas around New Mexico, we have brought up also in oil well cores, ceramics and artifacts and painting and spearheads and a lot of other implements that demonstrate that long before the Precambrian period, when the Precambrian seas washed a large part of the earth, there were men with some intelligence and culture, with painting, with art, and who recognized that they must have had something in the earth which they hunted, or for some reason they used these spearheads. Now we come into a later period. We start out with the book of Genesis. This book is written about the Adamic race. It's written to the Adamic race. It's written concerning God's kingdom. It's written concerning their responsibilities. And so there is the little foundation which is given that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Then the next thing that we have happening is the earth is without form and void, and darkness is upon the face of the deep. If you happen to have a Scofield Bible or other chain reference Bible, you'll note that between the first and second verse of Genesis, there is a notation that there is a vast expanse of time that takes place here. And in the notes, they tell you God originally created the earth, and then there was a great catastrophe that wiped out the early creations. If you turn to the fourth chapter of Jeremiah, he gives you a full description of those catastrophes, how whole areas of the earth were rolled over and covered up, how ancient places on the wilderness became wilderness, how cities disappeared, and how in its place now was jungle where once had been ancient civilizations. And then you start down with God recreating, how the Spirit of God moved upon the surface of the deep, how God started to reform, how he raised the land masses again, and how he started recreating and repopulating the earth. You will also know in the book of Genesis that he didn't make any fish. That all he said concerning the fish is let the waters continue to bring forth abundantly. Why? Because there had been fish from the earlier creations and he didn't have to create them, and there was plenty of water for them to swim in, and all he fixed was that they were to continue to bring forth abundantly. When you come on down through these years of development and millions of years of his creative purpose, you come down to the climactic age in which God populated the earth with the peoples, male and female, which he made on the sixth day, and told them to go out and repopulate the earth, showing that the earth had been populated before and the catastrophe had wiped out many of the early inhabitants. Now, if you did not recognize this, you will discover that this is biblically so. Now, this last race was quite evidently the Turanian race, and God placed them upon the face of the earth. And they were not very much different in natural characteristics from the oldest fossils we can define or find upon the face of the earth. We point out to you that this is quite evident. because when God had placed the Adamic race of the earth and had established them in an area he called Eden. Many people wonder where Eden is. Original Eden exists in the far-off Pamir Plateau, in what is now known as the area of the Tarim Basin. In fact, every one of the ancient peoples of earth and all of their ancient races talk about the tradition of the origin of man. When they use that word, the word Aryan or Manu comes from the Upper Tarim Basin. In other words, from that Upper Tarim Basin, the first white men ever to be seen upon the face of the earth emerge in the history of the world. The word Eden refers to an area far up in that area where there was an intense demonstration of plant life of every kind, and where in this upper high Tarim Basin there was an ideal situation even at that time in those days in climate, recorded today by India and by ancient China as well. Now we point out to you that in the 31st chapter of Ezekiel, which if you go home and read it, we'll not take the time tonight to go into that subject, God tells the emperor of Egypt, as well as he refers directly to other empires like the empire of Assyria, that they were great empires in the days of Eden. The word Eden actually means beginnings. And in the days of the beginnings, you were already great empires. Whose beginnings? The beginning of the Adamic race and of God's kingdom. So God tells the Egyptian how the empire of Assyria was over almost all the earth, and all the peoples and races dwelt under the branches of this great empire. He talks about the strength of the waters of the racial streams of the Sumerians, the ancient Turanians, the Asiatics. To the Egyptian, he said, we're also an old and great tree. You weren't as powerful as the Assyrian, but your dynasties existed in the days of Eden, yes? If you want to go back 5,000 years before Christ, the dynasties of early Egypt existed. If you want to go back 7,000 years before Christ, Horus as the great prophets' writings and the descendancy of the Horus priesthood was found to be in Egypt, and the Khufus, which were an ancient title of the priests and the rulers of a people that had migrated from lands beneath the waters of the Atlantic, according to their tradition. In fact, according to the tradition of the ancient Egyptians, great violations of divine law had occurred. Great catastrophes wrecked an ancient world. The volcanoes that erupted were penetrated by the waters of the ocean as it ran through the great crevices opened by earthquake. Steam blew the tops off of their mountains. Their whole continent shook and started to sink as the judgments of Yahweh Ptah, the great god of the heavens above, fell upon their land for their violation of law and paganism. They migrated, many of them, out of that land behind the leaders Horus and the Khufu of their race. They talked in those days about how high temples that existed in the ancient land of Alatkan, and how there was great temples unto Yah Ptah, now known to you as Yahweh, and how the administering spirits of his celestial sons were their administering priests in the temple, and how Yahweh withdrew them from the earth in the hour of Lucifer's great catastrophe. The ancient writings of Horus of the Egyptians, you'll discover that the ancient Egyptians record what the violation of divine law was. That a great and mighty archangel, you know this archangel is Lucifer, the fallen one, in great struggles in the earth came to earth. And when it came to earth, he brought the dark and curly-headed ones, who were not only warriors, but man, the fleets which were defeated. How bringing them to earth, he scattered them over the various continents under fallen angels, which angels they worshipped. In their discussion, the great catastrophe that transpired, according to the writing of the ancient Egyptians, was that they started to intermingle with these strange people, and that a catastrophe descended upon the earth. More than that, the violation of divine law, bestiality, corruption, immorality of the worst order, and violent bickerings and great struggles and mighty wars followed. And out of the writings of the ancient Egyptians, great and strange new powers brought to earth caused great devastation. The fire consumed parts of the earth. The earth rocked and rolled, the earth split open once the tremendous shaking started, water rushed into the inner fires, whole continents split, and eventually were plunged beneath the oceans. That's why Plato, educated down in Egypt in the great universities of your race and on, picked up the tradition that had been that of ancient Egypt, and that's why he went back and wrote about Atlantis, and that's why the story of Atlantis, the great continent of the Atlantic, was a part of the Western literature of Plato. I have in my libraries writings of ancient Horus, and it wasn't so long ago that opening up in the temples of Karnak some of the hidden rooms, they found some of the translations of the old documents of Horus that go back for thousands of years in the background of the Egyptians, and how one thing the Egyptians were told were going to happen, that in this day which was ahead, that in one of these days God would send to earth His own sons, and they would not come as they had spiritual beings in the temples of yesterday, but they would come embodied in physical form, spread and multiply upon the earth, build His kingdom, bring in His laws, and that when these white sons came, they would be the sons of the Most High, and that they were to be observed and to be recognized as God's children. Now that was known by them, and they looked for the children of Yahweh Phutah. That's why in those days, when your race first entered Egypt in the days of Enoch and Job, that they wrote that you were the children of Osiris, the call of Ra, coming into that land. Let's go back up to that great Tarim Basin, that high Pamir Plateau existing then over what now makes that basin, between the Teshean Mountains on one side and the mountains of Cush, as they are called, on the other, with the Indus upon one side and the mighty Himalayas flanking them on the other, was the paradise of God. Here four rivers that fulfill the exact names still run out of ancient Asia, even though that land is sunk and changed, and the words like Gihon and others are still given those names by the peoples of ancient India and China. We point out that basically significant were the patterns that out of these lands, the beginning, had moved out these different streams. We point out to you something rather significant. The one great conspiracy of Lucifer and his household is try to destroy the embodied race. Now, I don't think the devil even believes he can destroy spirit. And there are a lot of preachers that don't know as much as the devil. They think the spirits can be destroyed, but you can't destroy spirits. Some of these silly fellows think you can burn spirits with fire or torture them with some mechanical processes of pain. But I want you to know that spirits are not subject either to heat or to cold. But the sons and daughters of the Most High God were begotten of His Spirit. When He first started the setting of the Adamic race into earth by the establishment of the issue of God, which is Adam, and when that was established in that upper Pamir Plateau, it was surrounded by great and mighty empires of people already on the earth, according to the 31st chapter of Ezekiel. Now God made a statement that I want you to remember. I have put you in a garden which I planted because there was no man on the earth to till the soil, so I put you here, your soil tillers. You're men of civilization and culture. You will garden the earth for a supplement to the food supply. You will have this technological capacity which I bestowed upon you. And so Adam, which means the very life issue of God, the white man, was placed in earth and started out to till the soil. You go back into ancient India, which knows the white man as the Aryan and the Arius, and you will discover they call them lords of the soil, which is another very important thing that is used in the ancient Vedic writings of the peoples of India. I point out to you that these peoples were already existent in the earth before the coming of your race. When in that upper Tarim Basin they were thus placed, one of the first things that the Luciferian host decided, Lucifer decided that he was going to approach unto Eve, seduce Eve, destroy the bloodline, wipe out your race, absorb it from the beginning, and foil God's plan for His kingdom. Nobody foils God, not even Mr. Kennedy. I want to point out that God made a statement which is still preserved, even as much as there is an influence by theology sometimes to make changes. Trees. Of all of the food trees, which for fruit and for food that I have put in the garden, ye may eat. But there is one tree of which ye may not eat. An earlier translation was much clearer. Is that this is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is the tree of men, or Enosh, of the beings of earth. In other words, I have put you in the garden. Every fruit tree and fruit tree ye may eat of, but ye cannot mix in the fruit, the human fruit of the tree of nations. Tree and fruit tree ye may eat of, but ye cannot mix in the fruit, the human fruit of the tree of nations. You must preserve your own seed, a holy seed, for a purpose that I put you here for. I've surrounded you with light. I have given you my glory. Now you're not to cohabit with any other race. This Lucifer intervened with. Hath God said, well, God is lie. It is already a contemporary commentary of the ancient Zohar among the early masters of your race. that when they talked about a tree of knowledge of good and evil, it was talking about the experience and the intellects of man which had disobeyed the policies of God and the natural laws of God, and by this violation were aware of both good and evil, and of Lucifer, the son of the morning, once the archangel which had fallen, who still ruled over the earth with his fallen angels, and whose unassimilatable seed were now the masters of false religions already upon the face of the earth. And God pointed them out also as filling up the sum of good and of evil, and they had had knowledge of this. As we have mentioned in past sermons, the seduction of Eve by Baali, which was a name given unto Lucifer, who wore the symbol of the great serpent upon his head, was the result of the birth of Cain. It is for this reason that we read concerning Cain that in the days that Adam had become a part of this violation of law, but he turns and he asks Eve concerning the birth of Cain, and Eve said, I have received this man from Baali, translated here, the Lord. I point out that John in 2 John refers to Cain as the progeny of the wicked one. Jesus also proves this is so when he identifies a large number of the Palestinian Jews as descendants of Cain, who he said was of their father the devil, the lusts of their father ye will do. And he said, ye are the descendants, therefore, of the murderer, which was Cain, and of the devil, which was his father, who was also a liar from the beginning. Jesus makes it clear over here in John that he's talking about the devil and his progeny. And as we have recently pointed out in numerous sermons, when he gets over into the book of Matthew, and here we find Jesus talking to these forces of evil, and he points out to them that they are guilty of the blood, these Jews of Jerusalem, of all the righteous slain from Abel, marking the fact they were descendants of Cain. Now you may say, what has this to do with us? Just this, that over here in the book of Genesis, after Cain, the son of Lucifer, the son of Eve, but not of Adam, had slain Abel, who was the son of Adam and Eve, that he now was afraid. He was driven out of the presence of his family into a far country. The word here in your King James Version says that Cain says, my punishment is greater than I can bear. I have been driven off of the face of the earth. I think this is very important for you to understand tonight. When he said, I have been driven off the face of the earth, it is an improper translation. The word is E-R-A-T-Z, Eretz. That's a Hebrew word, and it means that country. I have been driven out of this country. Because we know the Canaanites are still on the face of the earth, and the word Eretz means that country, and any lexicon will prove it. Now we go a little farther. And it says that Cain went from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod. It was the land of Akkad, east of Eden. And there Cain found him a wife. And he knew this wife, and she conceived, and she bare one named Enosh. Not properly translated Enoch here, but in the original text is Enosh. He was a non-spirit beast creature. And after this, he builded a city. And he named this city after the name of his newborn son Enosh. Now I think it's quite easy to understand that if Cain, driven away from the white race, Luciferian offspring, went out and went into another land among another people and married him a wife among those people and raised a son, that by no stretch of the imagination did these people come from Adam. It is also quite obvious that these people became known as the Canaanites. And which people God warns from one end of the book of Genesis to the other, I have a war with. And the Amalekites are associated with the strains of this contaminated Canaanitish line. God says, I have a war with Amalek from generation unto generation. Again, the seed of the serpent will fight against the seed of the woman. He said the serpent would seek to bruise the seed of the woman, and the seed of the woman was going to bruise his head. Eventually, out of the race of the Adamic household was going to come the embodiment of God himself, whose mighty crushing of the head of the serpent would be a defeat to the forces of darkness. Now upon the earth that existed the peoples of Akkad, into which the Luciferian hosts through Cain were now joined, that existed, the ancient Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Africans, which you know as Negroes today, scattered on several continents and also among some of the islands. The violations of divine law existed in those days. The mixture of races, even the mixture of fallen angels that didn't keep their first estate. If you think I'm exaggerating concerning that condition, all you have to do is go over to read in the book of Jude what Jude says concerning these angels that didn't keep their first estate, but having fallen to earth, now took upon themselves human form and went after the strange flesh of peoples of earth, which God hath reserved in the judgments of blackness forever. This word being until the climax of the cycle and before the judgments of God. I point out to you that your race up in the Tarim Basin starts out with the fresh new life of Seth, the son of Adam. And Seth was a man which the scriptures here in Genesis said was begotten in the image of Adam. And Adam says, I have begotten a man in my own image. And we note that Seth and his offspring grow up and eventually move, some of them, out of that high Tarim Basin. Some of them migrated south into the lands and areas around Mesopotamia. Among those early migrants were a descendant of the house of Seth. One of these great men you have heard is known as Pohanok or Enoch. Another is Jobab or Job of the scriptures. Great shepherd kings and priests, they went down in the areas later known as Palestine and on the edge of Mesopotamia. They built here their great cities. Job, who was a high priest of the Most High and who had been visited by many experiences with God, was known also as a great leader and ruler and prince of peace. He lived in a city called Jerusalem, Ur-U-Salem, which was the first use of that word, which meant city of peace. Ur meaning city and Salem meaning peace. Ur of the Chaldees meant city of the Chaldees. It was here in this great city where Job and Enoch, descendants from the High Tarim Plateau, who had come down to the Persian Gulf and migrated from the Persian Gulf down into this area of Palestine, then not known as Palestine, then it was known as the land of Jerusalem. It was here that conceivable evil was to transpire. The powers of darkness led by the Canaanites, peoples gathered out of the Indus as well, and hordes that were brought down from the Asiatic steppes, led by the hordes of Cain and his descendants, moved against the peaceful cities wherein Job and Enoch had once lived. But in this period of time, Job and Enoch had fulfilled a destiny. They had gathered a group of savants and scholars and men of wisdom, for they understood the measurement of the sky, they understood the spiritual laws of the fulcrum, and mighty wisdom which God had shown unto Enoch when he carried him into the heavens and gave him a special training and education to build this city, to record these documents, to set up the great witness of the pyramid, and to leave a record for time. And so after this experience, Enoch had taken with Job a vast company. They went down to the land of On. There was some hostility until when these white men came with spiritual power and with great wisdom, and the documents of ancient Horus were read, that someday the sons of Yahweh Putah, embodied in earth and white men as such, would come down into their land and build a new altar unto their God, not unlike the shape of the temples which they had known in their ancient past. And the great pyramid is exactly like the pyramid to Yahweh Putah in ancient Atlantis that went down beneath the waters of the Pacific. Evidences of this are to be found in the antiquity of the records of the ancient Maya and the Incas, who had knowledge of these early temples. And for this reason why, you still see the semblance of these pyramid temples in the thinking of the ancient Maya, of the Tulapec, and of the ancient civilizations of ancient Mexico, whose pyramid-like structures were but a copy of the remembrance of the temples of their ancient past. The fact remains that in these days, Enoch, who was one of the blessed of the Lord, who not only loved God, but whose life was devoted to this task, was to become one of the great, most historical characters of all time. The reason I point this out is that in the meantime, there was a strategy of never having given up. Lucifer watched the development and growth of your race in this Tarim Basin. Immediately, there came in out of China and out of Asia and out of the great land of Petra, an unusual group of people, some of them monstrosities, fallen angels that had intermingled with earth orders, who had produced giants in those days, others that moved in various sizes, and some with great pomp and wealth. One of the strategies we are told in the ancient Zohar and also the writings of Enoch was that when these strangers came into this land of the Upper Tavian Basin from the outlying trees, that they brought into this land all types of procedures for pleasure. They brought with them strong liquors, and they brought with them all kinds of varieties of evil processes and designs. They set themselves up with pavilions and bazaars to entice the Adamic race. It says that some of the sons of Seth went down from the high mountain, and they went also to the valleys around to these strange festivities. You know, one of the oldest records of the books of the bee, this is to be found, the writings of the days of the books of the bee by Seth, you'll discover that one of the oldest temptations which was they tried to lure the sons of Adam was to show them the tremendous wealth and riches that could be gotten by associating with them. And they made gold and silver and trinkets and apparel look as of greater value than the spiritual origin of their race. It tells us that they lured them with women, they lured them with trinkets of gold and silver, and they lured them with the prizes of the racing of horses. So you see, that ancient sport of the kings is one of the oldest diversities of all time with which they lured men down to their bazaars in order that they might carry home the prizes which were offered to them. And we are told that it wasn't long before they came in, and some of them were actually the consorts of Lucifer, angels and descendants of them called Nephilim that hadn't kept their first estate. You say, well, Dr. Swift, there's no scripture for it, but there is. If I can show you the supporting evidences from old texts, and so I can show you from the King James Version the supporting evidences of what I say, even in this text. What it says is, as men began to multiply in the face of the earth, this word is Adamite, and there were daughters born unto them, that the Nephilim, translated here sons of God, but means fallen angels, and in the text you'll see the word is Nephilim, and if you go into the Zohar, you'll find it's Nephilim, and even the Jews admit it in their own Talmud that these Nephilim were mighty ones, and they served the devil, and you served God, so they came from them. Now listen. It says, Yahweh looked down and saw that these Nephilim saw the daughters of men, and they were fair, and they took them wives, all of which they chose. The older text says they seized by violence and absorbed all the women they designed to take. And we are told in the expanded versions of the Zohar and the earlier writings from the days that go back to the early scriptures, that in those days they not only had seduced them, but they seized women by force. And those that continued to resist, they ate them. Now, their worship was Lucifer, Baali. And the priests of Baal were Cana, from which you get the word canonization today. And they were eaters of human flesh, or white men, and they were called Cana Baals. Today you still call eaters of human flesh priests of Baal, or cannibals, from whence this word has come. And it's old in the semantics of men. The original text, God said, my spirit shall not always strive with embodied men, because they are flesh, but their days shall remain 120 years. And there were giants in the earth in those days after the intermingling of these Nephilim with the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. Some of them were mighty men of great renown. That's because in the process of the mitosis that follows, the strange energy factor that controls the spindle factors determines the development of the cells and has the energy image of the mean difference between the two sperm and ovum pattern cells will determine the height. Thus it was these mighty angelic hosts, now having changed their first estate, did not change the energy factor of their celestial beings, and in the processes which followed, the great and strange formation of giants took place. A violation of divine law, a crossing between two species, and white Jews came into being in great numbers. You know the difference between a red Jew, a black Jew, a yellow Jew, or a white Jew? It's this, my friends, what race was contaminated by this fallen satanic descendancy? Now, there are a lot of Jews don't like that, but that doesn't make any difference to me, because we don't make the word, we report it. I haven't any reason to like them anyhow. They're trying to destroy our nation, take away prayer out of our schools, the worship of our God. They're behind communism. They're behind all the Negro problems and racial crisis of our time. And if they don't like America, let's get down to Israel in a hurry. I hope they all make it before the great quake. God saw the wickedness of the Enosh. And he saw that it was great upon the earth. Every imagination of the thoughts of their heart were evil continually. Can you imagine what contamination had done? Luciferian influences in that area of the upper Tarim Basin had made every thought and every process of the people in that whole area wicked and evil continually. You know what's the best thing to do when you get something that's like that? Stamp it out. Oh, you say, no, Dr. Swift, shouldn't talk that way. I'm just telling you what God said. God said the thing to do is wipe it out. You know, Jesus says the first thing I'm going to do when I get back to earth, I'm going to pick out these rascals and wipe them out. Somebody said, well, that's a bad thing to do. That's the one way you eliminate evil and protect millions and millions of people. So what happens to them? Well, you put them someplace else where they're not in the dimension where they can do evil and where the work of God's grace can work on them in the ages to come. So let me tell you this. God says, therefore, I'm going to destroy the man which I have created from the face of the earth, both man, beast, and creeping things, fowls of the air, repenteth me that I have made them. But God never repented of anything, because God knew everything before it happened. And the word here is not properly translated. For God said, I will destroy the Enosh out of this land which I have created, and I will destroy also the beasts and the creeping things of this land, for I have determined that they shall not destroy that which I have made. So God was going to wipe out the monstrosities of the Enosh that were already contaminated by Lucifer from that land, because they were determined to wipe out what God had created, and God says they're not going to wipe it out. And I'm going to take a little hope from that tonight. They're not going to wipe out God's kingdom, and they're not going to wipe the white man out, and they're not going to wipe out Christianity and God's destiny for the earth. Now let's take a look over here at the book of Luke. Jesus said, the days will come when ye shall desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man. He says, they shall say to you, see here, see there. For as lightning that cometh out from one part of the heaven and shineth unto another, so shall the coming of the Son of Man, incarnate God, be. With great majesty, with great glory, with the speed of light, suddenly the great and mighty hosts of heaven are going to appear on earth. But how do you know such a time? Well, first, some must suffer many things and be rejected of that generation. But as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. Now you say they were, what does it mean? They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood destroyed those on the outside. Someone said, what does this mean, as it was in the days of Noah? The great conspiracy against your race today is an attempt to mongrelize and absorb it, to roll them together in eating and drinking and giving in marriage. There's nothing wrong with eating, nothing wrong with drinking, to be temperate in all things, but there's surely something wrong with mongrelization. Someone said, you don't condone all kinds of eating, all kinds of drinking. No, there's a lot of things you can eat and drink that I don't want any part of. But I'm not going beyond the words of the Apostle Paul, who said, let no man judge you in what you eat or what you drink. Just don't be Cana Bales. But let me tell you this. There is something very vitally wrong with the way that they were seized and absorbed and the way they were integrated and seduced, in which they mongrelized their race and their heritage. This, there was something definitely wrong. The book of Ezra says that even as in his time, the mingling of the holy seed was the greatest of transgressions. Now, God was not going to have the white race all stamped out. He was not going to have the race even in this part of it. For the strains of that race that were in Egypt were only a special remaining priesthood. Long before the waters of the flood, the Canaanites had come down out of the hills and wiped out the city of Jerusalem in the ancient land of Palestine. Having wiped it out, they had built the cities of the Canaanites, which were Jericho and Ai. After the judgments of God descended, the waters, you're told that Adam and Eve and their descendancy had started from the days of Eden on down to Noah, and you've got a perfect line of genealogy. You don't have all the genealogy summed up in Noah's house, for part of it's down already in the land of Egypt with Enoch and Job. But you have God telling Noah that you and your family are the only uncontaminated group left, except for a few isolated cases, and if you can persuade them to join you in this ship, I tell you the bills, that they can get on the inside and be saved from a judgment I'm going to send to destroy these giants and this evil posterity. And so he gave him the specifications, and Noah built one of the biggest wooden boats that was ever built. Built it out of proper hardwoods, and you know that was a good piece of carpentry, and parts of that boat are still existent over in Asia today, where frozen in the snows of the high mountain, which is called Ararat, many high mountains are called Ararat, is still a replica or a remnant of the ark. They took wood from this ark, which is actually in Siberian territory, in the western flanks of it, down to the university in France, in Paris, and the radiocarbon proves it to be of the proper antiquity and time to have measured up for the period of the flood. The last time that I had a visit with Dr. Adam Rutherford, he was again in contact with these archaeologists and was going to make his second contact with them to discover further factors concerning these findings, because the records were right in his chronology concerning the time of the flood. I point out to you that it is rather significant that when the flood came, that the Bible was literally fulfilled. Adam, or Noah rather, and his wife and his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Now let's get this clear. A man and his wife have three sons, and all three sons belong to the same family, and believe it or not, they belong to the same race. You know, I've heard more theological nuts running around say they believe God and everybody on the face of the earth came from Ham, Shem, and Japheth. They got all fantastic things that God did. He cursed them, he changed their colors, he moved them around, and not one of these things is biblically so. Wasn't any reason for it. Also, we know that all the wildlife of that land, again, the word is a rat, means all that country, entered the ark either by pairs or seven male and seven female of every eatable and clean life. We know, as we've mentioned before, that there are 3 million species on the face of the earth. And there were not enough boats in all the world, nor is there today, to carry all the creatures that would have been on that ark of Noah if it covered all the world instead of that place. There are not too many creatures lived at that high upper Tamir plateau, but he did preserve as God directed. And we know how long it rained. And we know the water lifted the ark, and there it was. We know these 120 days were 120 long days. We know the waters of subsidence. We know that had the water covered every part of the earth, including the Himalayas, it would have been almost 7 miles deep over the city of Los Angeles. There wouldn't have been any place where it had to have gone to when it receded. There wouldn't be any recession spot. We know within the period of a short time after that flood, according to the writings here in the book of Genesis, that the floodwaters had subsided. And we read here how Noah left the ark. And with him, he took with him his three sons and their wives. And we are told that from this hour that the ark rested in the seventh month on the 17th day on the top of Ararat. For we are told that the flood had come from the fountains of the deep being broken up, as well as the belts of the heavens being broken. So that the water that came from the vast condensation of water belts of the atmosphere and the earthquake which brought water up from the bottom and which brought together this great catastrophe affected only that upper place. As we've told you before, the catastrophe followed with great earthquakes. The waters ran down the Wangho rivers of China through one cataract and down to Mesopotamia through another. We tell you that it was some time before all that vast inland sea eventually subsided. If you go to the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, you'll find, if you look into the upper Tamir Plateau and Tarim Basin, that it tells about how this area was once a vast sea in ancient Asia, an underground sea, and then a great upheavals take place, and that the Tishan Mountains have subsided and are 5,000 feet lower than they used to be. And how this water is the water of the floods of China and of the floods of Asia, but it didn't drown everybody because they wrote about it and told about it afterwards. You know, when the flood drowns everybody, there's nobody left to write about it except the survivors. And if the Chinese write about it and the other peoples write about it, they were not drowned because they tell what happened. Of course, there are those people foolish enough today to think that the Asiatics and the Negroids came from these people. I want to point out to you that this is quite impossible. Down in the opening up at Thebes of some of the temples of the ancient Egyptians, we have dynasties that go way back into the pre-Adamic period. We have paintings on the walls of that ancient burial temple at Thebes of one of the oldest pre-flood dynasties in Egypt. And on the wall are paintings of white men, of Negroes, of Egyptians, and of Asiatics. And you tell the Egyptians from the other Turanians as being lighter and having certain marks which were hoteps of their leaders on them. Now, this is before the flood, so you have Negroes before the flood, and of course we know we've got 73,000 years of their history because they were buried in the caves of Kilimanjaro. So now, by no stretch of the imagination, did Negroes or Asiatics come from the sons of Noah when they existed before the flood, and when the Egyptians were never drowned during the flood? For when Abram was born in the land of Ur of the Chaldees, he was born in a land after the flood and went down into Egypt, and the Egyptians were still there. Now let me point something out to you. If you come over here in the descendants of Noah, you have Ham, Shem, and Japheth. They were all white men. The descendants of Ham, which included Cush and Mizraim Phut, and Cush was the father of Nimrod. Nimrod was a great and mighty conqueror and ruler. It is said he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Whereas it is said even Nimrod was this mighty hunter before Yahweh. And in the beginning of his kingdom was the conquest. Now listen, he conquered Babel, Erech, Akkad, Kalnak, and the land of Shinar. Now I want you to do some thinking. Here is the grandson of Noah, or great-grandson of Noah. And he comes down out of that upper Tarim Basin when after the flood they migrated to the shores of the Persian Gulf. He goes down into the plain of Shinar in Mesopotamia and he conquers there the land that is here described as Babel, Erech, Akkad, Canaan, the land of Shinar. And actually he overthrew the land from whence Cain took his wife. He overthrew the land of Babel where later he built a tower which was to be called the Tower of Babel. He conquered Arak. Now I want you to know that you won't go down. A great-grandson of a man who only had two other sons and find whole civilizations existing by the time the great-grandson goes down. You say, well, where'd they come from? The millions of men that were conquered by this man, Nimrod, came from pre-Adamic or came from pre-flood periods. In fact, we are told in the ancient records the reason why that Nimrod came and conquered these lands were because of what he had heard had been done to the other descendants of the white race who had settled in ancient Jerusalem, or the peoples from whence Job and Enoch came. The great errors that followed in Nimrod's time was that he listened to the one-worlders of his day. Satan never changed his plan. Always build a one-world government, elevate somebody to a great position of responsibility, try to take over a white man if you can, promising strength and power, telling him he's the greatest, and then use him as the tool while you seek to mongrelize races and build a city. And Ur of the Chaldees, city of the Chaldees, was that mongrelized kind of city. For Terah, the father of Abraham, was prime minister, another white man, to the white king Nimrod when in the land of Ur, Abraham was born. You're told in the book of Jasher, when Abraham was born, he was sent down to when he was 12 years old to be taught of Noah in the caves of Noah, and then he returned unto his father's house. We haven't time to discuss all the things that happened then, but I think it's very important for you to know this, that in the days of Noah, the attempt which brought the catastrophe of that flood was mongrelization, the attempt to absorb the race and to wipe you out. This is Satan's own line. When later he tried to conquer the conqueror Nimrod, again was to get him to make a cosmopolitan city out of Asia and Africa and roll it into one. And they turned his head until they were creating an idolatrous race even around himself. And they did just what God said. If you let these people come in and dwell among you, they'll turn your head. And they'll get you to worshiping other gods. God doesn't even want you to let the pagan come in and dwell in your land. Now listen. The scripture therefore points out that Jesus said, in this great climactic hour, with all the prophecies of my nations in fulfillment, when I have taken this seed of my covenant, when they have become a great people and a company of people, when this hour just before my return, they are great nations of the earth, and all the hordes of darkness as prophecies in Ezekiel, or the writings of Daniel, or the vision of Revelation show, when all the forces of darkness want to overthrow God's kingdom, when Mystery Babylon is ruled by these strange sons of Satan who have become my merchants according to the book of Revelation, when this day has come, when they seek to absorb you and mongrelize you, when I've warned you through my prophets not to make a covenant with them and not to enter into an alliance with them, in that day it will be as it was in the days of Noah. And I think that you should understand this today, for it's related to the power behind the influence of administrations. It's behind court decisions. It's behind the plan of the Asia conferences. It's behind the plan to abolish your immigration laws. It's behind the plan to flood your country with every race and color and then force them into your housing projects and into your schools and into association with your young people in high school and college, and ultimately hopes to sell them a false concept, marry them, absorb them, destroy spiritual seeds, get them to worship other gods, knock prayer and faith and the service of God out of their lives and out of their education, and end up like a great mongrel race that Lucifer can rule. So he's trying it again. This is the last time, and he's going to strike out. For as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be the days of the coming of the Son of Man. This intermarriage among races is the curse of Noah's day and also of yours. Now we point this out to you because it takes on significance. In that day, God suddenly introduced a deluge that wiped out everybody that didn't get on the ark. Today, the white race and the children of God, the Christians of this hour, are in a new ark. And that ark is in the ark of their faith, built around the recognition of who the Messiah was, the completeness of his atonement, the justification of his grace, the nations of his kingdom, the covenants of his purpose. This great ark of faith is the ark made by the person of Jesus Christ. And I point out to you today that it is in this ark, this identity, this great Christian civilization and culture that you're a part of by faith, by destiny, by birth, that you are going to find the salvation of God applies to this hour as God sends a new flood upon mankind. You say, he said, I'll never send a flood to destroy all flesh of the earth. No, my friends, this time the flood is going to be the great overwhelming flood of the armies of the Most High God, who will pour fire down out of the skies and consume the very cities of your enemies from the face of the earth. I can tell you one thing. These enemies of God's kingdom that hate the name of Jesus Christ and boast about it in their Yiddish papers, they'd better be catching planes and boats for Palestine. And then if they're real smart and read the Bible, they'll go hide even farther away than that. If they could understand the scriptures, which they cannot, they would be praying for God to have mercy on them for the evil they have caused. Because Jesus said, every plant that my Father did not plant, I'm going to pluck out by the roots. He said, I'm going to bring in my holy angels, and they're going to pluck the tares out, the children of the wicked one. Takes too much time to finish a subject like this. But I want you to know that you're in the latter days, as it was in the days of Noah. Not just a few giants, but the massive program of Satan's kingdom wants to mongrelize your race. They want to implement it with troops. They want to back it by every conspiratorial measure that Satan dreams up. And some of these brainwashed people are lifting up a standard of self-righteousness, which is Satan's own lie, behind this shield they march to destroy. Why, they don't even have a good sense concerning their own family. Just to prove this, the President of the United States opened up a kindergarten in his own home and brought Negroes right into it with his own daughter, and Jacqueline has to be raised with Negroes in the White House. So you see, this is one place where they have been brainwashed and controlled to the point that they introduce it even in their own midst. They probably scrub him real hard, though, before they let him come in. I just point this out to show you that we can have degeneration from the top, but we're going to have a great groundswell of victory as God awakens his sons and daughters, and they're going to do exactly what Malachi the prophet said they do in the last days. The sons will remember their fathers, and the fathers are going to think about the destiny of their children, and they're going to return to the laws of God. One of the great events that a lot of people will not appreciate, and many who may hear this tape, absorb and reflect upon its content until I tell them that Christ will step back into human affairs and help to settle this thing for your race in a mighty victory, in which he has not relieved you of the responsibility of occupying till he arrives, but he assures you that arrive he will. Someone said, aren't you worried about the judgments comparable with the destruction of the first flood, now to be in the renovation and catastrophe that envelops the evil powers of earth? No, I'm not worried about what God's bringing in. I can't wait for him to get here with it. Someone said, well, Dr. Swick, we're all sinners saved by grace. Shouldn't we be afraid? No, my friends, you please your Father when you stand tall, look him in the face and say, come on in, Lord Jesus. You justified me by thy grace. There's no charge against me. There's no power in earth. There is no force of evil that can separate me from thy love. God will give you more honor for that faith than all the groveling, kneeling, worrying of people that don't have enough of it. You can't supplement the cross of Christ with anything. And you can't destroy the mighty power of that atonement. And you don't have to be ashamed, and you don't have to be abased. You can say with Paul, now are we the sons of God. It may not appear what we shall be, but when he shall appear, we're going to be like him. And I'm going to tell you this. He's coming in with a long sword and a big sickle. He's coming in to reap the grapes of wrath and to trample the wine presses of judgment. But I want you to know tonight that you're a part of this battle. Don't surrender. Don't give in. If they are going to try to force your race by violence, then we shall meet them in like token. But let me assure you this, that in this occupation have no fear. I'll be like a wall of fire about you. No weapon that's formed against you shall prosper. Give me thy hand, Jacob, and you shall walk with me. And again I say to you that you're not alone, as we said this afternoon. For he said, I will never leave you nor forsake you, even unto the end of the age.